Education advocates are calling on the legislature and governor to resolve a lawsuit over money owed to public schools. And they want it done quickly in a special session.
I'm an optimist, and I know that the governor and the legislature share our commitment to doing what's right for kids. And so at the end of the day, we certainly believe that they will do what is right.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Scottsdale changes course on a non-discrimination ordinance, trying to protect Arizona's military bases from encroachment,
giving students with autism a new educational experience.
And Mexico's president wants his country to build a better partnership with its northern neighbor.
He needs support, especially from the border states, to try to increase trade and try to build relationships, you know, deeper relationships with the United States via the border.
Plus, millennials and the drought, and we drop the puck.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Typically this time of year, storms roll in 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Well, we already have a blowing dust advisory in effect for the valley until 3. And if you're anywhere near the central part of the city, you're already seeing a lot of dust. So drive carefully. It's currently 99 degrees. And in traffic, there is an accident to watch out for on the 202 westbound at I-10. It's blocking the off-ramp.
Education advocates gathered this morning at the state capitol. They want Governor Doug Ducey and the state legislature to call a special session to resolve the issue of inflation funding to schools. A state judge has ruled Arizona owes its public schools more than $1 billion in payments not made to account for inflation. The judge has already ordered the state to pay more than $300 million. Jonathan Parker teaches AP U.S. History at Thunderbird High School in the Glendale Union High School District.
Since 2008, we have done little to incentivize this profession. We are not enticing teachers to this profession. We are chasing some of our best to other professions. And that is a legislative choice. Insufficient funding is easily defined. There is no political ambiguity for my colleagues.
So how optimistic are advocates that there will be a special session to resolve this issue? I put that question to Jennifer Johnson. She's executive director of Support Our Schools AZ and a former deputy state superintendent.
Yes, I'm an optimist, and I know that the governor and the legislature share our commitment to doing what's right for kids. And so at the end of the day, we certainly believe that they will do what is right.
What do you make of the governor's land trust proposal? His office is saying that, look, the governor called for this lawsuit to be resolved. He's advocating putting all this extra money into the classroom. Does that do it for you?
Well, I think ultimately we're going to look at the results, not just the rhetoric of the conversation. We want to see actual decisions made, actual commitments kept. You know, the inflation lawsuit is one step in a much longer journey towards equitable, stable, and sufficient funding for Arizona's public schools. So it's not an either-or situation. It's not the governor's land trust proposal in lieu of settling the inflation funding lawsuit. It's all of that. It's settling the inflation funding lawsuit. It's continuing the discussion about our state policymakers' commitment to the children of Arizona and the economic prosperity of the state. It's not a simple solution. It's not a single faceted conversation. It's about doing a number of things to position Arizona's education system to provide the world-class education that we know our children deserve.
Do you have a sense of where you would like for the money to come from to pay for this inflation funding?
Well, the money that could be used to settle this inflation lawsuit is in the bank for the state today. If you look at the state surplus and you look at the rainy day fund, there is more than enough to settle what the court has ordered the legislature to do.
What happens if what you're calling on the governor and the legislature to do doesn't happen? I mean, what's the result there?
Well, we're certainly going to try to continue the conversation. We respect the fact that these elected officials have responsibilities, and we want to be part of a team of people who continues to try to help bring about a positive resolution. So we will continue conversations with legislators and the governor's office. We will continue to try to bring resources and, influence and the voices of the parents that elected them to office to bear in this conversation. So we're just going to continue until we ultimately get what we know our children deserve and what not only our children need, but the state of Arizona needs.
Have you had those kinds of conversations with members of the legislature or the governor's office already?
A number of parent leaders have had those kinds of conversations on an ongoing basis because school funding has been an issue for, some would say, years. Certainly, over the last few years, Arizona has suffered significant cuts to education. And so this conversation isn't new. We didn't just decide to begin the conversation with our policymakers over the last few days or few weeks. It has been going on for a long time, and it will continue to go on because we're seeking positive resolutions on behalf of our children.
Jennifer Johnson is Executive Director of Support Our Schools AZ. We also reached out to the governor's office. In an email, a gubernatorial spokesman pointed out Governor Ducey called for ending the lawsuit early in his administration and says he's willing to listen to any idea that gets more money to schools without raising taxes.
Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto gave his State of the Nation address last night and surprised some observers by combining a positive tone, typical of these kinds of speeches, with a dose of realism, including acknowledging the country's crime and corruption problems. Alfredo Corchado is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News and followed Peña Nieto's speech. Alfredo, what was different about this address?
It's interesting what a difference a year makes. I mean, he was, I thought, incredibly blunt in acknowledging that it's been a very difficult year. He acknowledged the scandals, human rights violations. He mentioned Ayotzinapa, not using the word Ayotzinapa, but the massacre in Iguala. Even talked about the prison escape of Chapo Guzman. I think for many Mexicans, that's a good start. I mean, it's certainly something different than coming 3 years ago when he took office and said, this is Mexico's moment, and almost tried to change the narrative of the country. I mean, overlooking the fact that more than 100,000 people at that time had been killed or disappeared, not really wanting to talk about the violence, the corruption, the disappearances, etc. He still has 3 years in his terms, 3 years to try to reboot his administration and try to get some things done.
If, in fact, he is committed to making the changes that you mentioned, if people can believe what he said in his address, does he have the force, does he have the power to make those changes? And if he had, why didn't it happen the first couple of years?
I think he came in thinking that, with the majority in Congress, the PRI was back, the party that governed Mexico for 70 years. A lot of people in Mexico question whether he really knew how deep Mexico was in problems. I mean, all the issues that were facing it. I mean, I thought I was there when he took office, and I thought, wow, this guy just does not really understand where Mexico is at this moment. But Mexico has an election in 2018, and you already have politicians jogging for position for the presidential race. He has a tiny, tiny window. I mean, there were still so many problems ahead that, yes, he has time. He does have the Congress backing him, but he's also going to need a lot of help from the U.S., especially southwest border states like Arizona, Texas. The Texas governor, Abbott, is headed to Mexico this weekend. The Arizona governor was there in June. I mean, he needs support, especially from the border states, to try to increase trade and try to build relationships, deeper relationship with the United States via the border.
And certainly here we talk a lot about how Mexico is such an important trading partner for Arizona. Do a majority of people in Mexico think that's a positive, to open up more trade with the U.S., whether Texas, Arizona, or the broader U.S.?
What's interesting, when the Arizona governor went there in June, I think a lot of Mexicans, at least analysts and experts, were hoping that the governor would talk about issues like immigration. But it seems to be still a very thorny issue. And so just the idea that he's talking about trade and focus on the economics, I think, is a good sign for Mexico that at least the two sides are talking. At least that's the impression that we got following the visit.
Alfredo Corchado is with the Dallas Morning News. He's also author of the book Midnight in Mexico. Alfredo, thank you for the insights.
My pleasure, Steve.
A new partnership was agreed to late last month between the Maricopa Association of Governments and Mexico's biggest industrial chamber group. The collaboration will support a web-based connection tool, a business-to-business site called ConnectBN.com. Dennis Hoffman, economist at ASU's W.P. Carey School, says it's an important step to improve communication between the Valley and Mexico.
Businesses operate efficiently when they have full information. And what this latest effort is, in my opinion, is it's about information and information flow. So it's the ability for businesses to connect not only around the region, but across the borders. Steve, I really believe that this is a trend that has taken place not only in Phoenix, but in many, many cities. Economic development used to be pretty easy for us in Phoenix. We just waited for the next 100,000 people to move in. We have to work at it a bit more now. And this isn't government being overbearing. This, to me, kind of flashes back. I see in bits and pieces here, you know, things that would be very consistent with, you know, the old notion of the Phoenix 40 and some of the founding Phoenix business leaders thinking about ways that the Valley could grow by connecting Mexico with Phoenix, connecting Canada with Phoenix.
What are the advantages to Mexico of doing this?
Exports are increasingly important to a country like Mexico. So thinking about business connectivity, growing businesses that depend upon trade, and trade even at intermediate levels. And that's why I see this particular effort so interesting. This is about connecting supply chains. It's the case these days that a particular product will pass over the border several times before it's actually completed production. This connection of supply chains, this awareness of what levels of manufacture, what levels of production prevail both sides of the border is really, really very important.
Are we in a position now where the relationship between Arizona and Mexico has gotten back to, let's say, a reliable, stable level that may have gotten real bumpy, not only with the economic downturn, the Great Recession, but also, of course, SB 1070. If we at any point start to fall back from that, do you feel like the business community feels strongly enough about this kind of thing to say, hold on, even if we're not talking morals here, we need the economic benefit?
Let's go back to 1962, when at the 50th year anniversary of the state, Barry Goldwater was asked to forecast what would the state look like at the 100-year anniversary in 2012. And Barry listed a number of things, but one of the things that he listed is he said that the Mexico-Arizona border, the Mexico-U.S. border, would be very much like the Canadian-U.S. border, because commerce would flow freely, because the economies would be so entwined that commerce would flourish between the two countries. So, yes, I think we candidly did lose our way. What got conveyed was that Arizona was closed for business when it came to international labor markets, international commerce. So, yes, we can hope that we've kind of gone back to our roots, as it were, and that this is a kind of a signal that we embrace trade.
Economist Dennis Hoffman of the Sieben Institute at the W.P. Carey School of Business. Dennis, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Still to come, students with autism become a part of a community college campus starting this year.
Being in a community, able to interact with peers, have those social experiences of a young adult, being on Gateway campus, all of those other opportunities are available.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It is the show on KJZZ on this murky Thursday afternoon. Blowing dust advisory in effect for the Valley until 3 o'clock. And there may be some heavy rain to follow. We'll see how that develops. At this point, we're still at 99 degrees in the Valley. In traffic, accidents on I-17 northbound at I-10. Also the 202 westbound at I-10 that's blocking the off-ramp. Also a collision in the intersection, I-17 northbound at 19th Avenue. And there's a collision blocking the right lane, I-17 northbound at Deer Valley. It's 218.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering USDA prime steaks, chef-prepared salads, and a selection of craft beers for Labor Day weekend. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
The city of Scottsdale is reevaluating a non-discrimination law designed to protect the LGBT community. KJZZ's Phil Latzman is with us. And Phil, the longtime mayor of Scottsdale has mixed feelings about enacting an ordinance similar to those in other Arizona cities?
He does, Steve. The Scottsdale Council voted this Monday to move forward with a law that would protect members of the LGBT community. This comes after a previous decision that called for a non-binding anti-discrimination pledge. Mayor Jim Lane was one of the two dissenting votes on the council. He says this type of ordinance, similar to the ones that passed in Phoenix and Tempe, could put undue burden on businesses and stigmatize those who oppose it. For example, he said that someone's actions could be misconstrued as discriminatory, even if it wasn't their intent. He also told me that he thinks it's important to consider the feelings and beliefs of those who may oppose the law.
In some instances, there's criminal charges with fines and everything else on the basis of a perception of discrimination. There's other terms in some of the ordinances that other cities have passed that are difficult for those people on the other side, and most notably because they're targeted sort of as the enemy on this, and that is the Christian community. So, and that's been in some of the rhetoric on both sides, obviously, that puts forward. But if you don't pass the ordinance, it constitutes a sort of a self-proclamation that you are bigoted, non-inclusive, unfriendly, and unwelcoming.
So, Mr. Mayor, what does the city of Scottsdale have to do in lieu of passing that ordinance to get rid of its reputation, whether it's citywide or statewide, that it's unwelcoming to the LGBT community?
Well, let me just first establish the fact that it's a misperception as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know that it isn't by design, put there in front of us as somewhat of a formulated guilt issue. But nevertheless, what can we do? What we could do and what I felt to do is to rely upon the good nature, just the simple good human nature of people here in Scottsdale. And I believe that There is no, to the best of my knowledge, there isn't a bias against the LGBT community. But really, to try to answer your question, I guess what I was hoping to do, and I think we were successful in large part of that, is to have the community make that proclamation, make that statement through the pledge.
Mr. Mayor, I did speak with a few people who say they had been discriminated against in Scottsdale, and that codifying a law such as this would ensure that doesn't happen again. And of course, what's been in the news has been the story about the clerk in Kentucky refusing marriage licenses. Certainly, that's not a comparison, but it's on people's minds.
Yeah, here's the thing with that. That's a government agency. I'm not sure that she's in the right place. I mean, if that's a problem for her. If somebody has different values or different thoughts or different beliefs, and they're not doing anything, I just don't believe. We're a tourist community. And this is one of the, obviously the somewhat veiled threat is that they will, if we don't do this, that will be branded and thus somehow damaged. And that's what, is certainly concerns a lot of the businesses. Frankly, the entire city. To answer your question, to avoid that, the only thing that probably is for us to pass the ordinance. Now, that's that we're on a path to evaluate it, but we're very, very seriously concerned about some of what has developed in those communities where the ordinances have been passed. And I don't mean here locally, just across the country with regard to real discrimination and denunciation and disregard for other people's values and beliefs. So it's become a little bit of a war.
Mayor Jim Lane of Scottsdale, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Well, thank you, Phil. It was nice talking with you.
So, Phil, what comes next?
Well, the Scottsdale Council, Steve, has asked the city manager to explore options for this proposed new law that would provide official protections for the LGBT community.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Phil, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Students with autism have a new place to take classes. The Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center, or SARC, has partnered with an organization called First Place to offer classes at Gateway Community College in Phoenix. Paige Rates is director for the Residential Transition Academy through First Place, which is operated by SARC.
We have a transition academy where we work with young adults with autism spectrum disorders, and we're partnering with Gateway to have a certificate program where these individuals will take classes over 2 years, and they'll earn a certificate in independent living skills.
Is there some significance to having it at Gateway as opposed to at the facilities you normally have your classes at?
Absolutely. Having this at Gateway really gives us the opportunity to be in an integrated setting, allows our students to be with their peers. They get opportunities to take other classes outside of our certificate program, and they get to really experience that college life, both the social and the educational opportunities that come with that.
So what does the certificate mean to the students once they get it?
Individuals will take 35 classes over a two-year period where they will learn the skills that they need to live independent lives upon graduation. They'll take classes in things like personal finance, interpersonal relationships, personal safety, and upon completion, they will have the skills that they need to be able to live independently in their communities and the communities of their choosing.
Is there interaction with Gateway students or other students who are taking classes at the campus who are not necessarily in these particular classes?
Our students have that opportunity. They can participate in the social events that happen on campus. They have full access to the community. So there's lots of opportunities when they're commuting to campus, similar to other students, hopping on the light rail, getting to their classes. Additionally, the courses will open up at some point for other students who are not a part of the academy.
Did these students have a place to take these kinds of classes before now, and could they take them at SARC as opposed to having them at Gateway?
Really, in the past, classes that have been offered have really been more one-off classes, if you will. We haven't had this comprehensive curriculum over a two-year span. And ideally, again, being in a community, able to interact with peers, have those social experiences of a young adult on a campus was something that we just couldn't offer in our building. And now, being on Gateway campus, all of those other opportunities are available.
Do students who are on the autism spectrum often have the chance to go to community college or a four-year university?
When we look at the recent National Autism Indicators Report, Transitioning into Young Adulthood, we find that 74% of young adults with ASD have no post-secondary educational experiences. So a large number of students with an ASD are graduating from a high school program and not experiencing that next step in their education.
Do you expect that this program will continue after this initial two-year program?
Absolutely. We look to have this program be available to students and young adults for a long time.
Paige Rates is director of Residential Transition Academy with the Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center, or SARC. Paige, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The classes started last week and currently have 6 students enrolled, although eventually they could hold as many as 32. Frank Zamora is chair of the counseling department at Gateway Community College, where the classes are being held.
I think for us, about a year ago, we were presented with an opportunity to expand into our community. We feel that the people around the area are a community, and so we were approached about a year ago by First Place, which is part of the SARC, and we looked at what their needs were to help their students and thought it was a viable thing to do, and it would help not only them but our community, and so we thought we'd take an opportunity to do that and to help their population.
How does this program help students at Gateway?
So as far as our students are concerned, it kind of twofold. It helps our students that are already there at Gateway. One of the things that I'm trying to do is through our federal work study program, start to groom those students that are interested in going into that area to help autistic students. And so in teaching, I'm also a faculty member, in some of my classes, I asked students that are interested in working with autistic students, and I was able to come up with three. And so it helps our students have another avenue to go in and support autistic children or adults. And then it also helps at Gateway our students because they become our students. There is no separation between the SARC students or first place students and our students, so they're able to be a part of our family.
So are you envisioning a certain amount of interaction between the SARC students and the Gateway students?
Well, the intent is so that it's seamless. We want the SARC students or first place students to feel comfortable. It's their campus. And one of the cool things that has come from this is one of the first things we have done at the beginning of this semester is to have an orientation. And in the orientation, we walked them around campus, made sure that they knew where all the resources are, because once they are on our campus, they have access to everything we have on our campus.
Is there a hope that if these students decide later on, once they have their certificate, that they might want to take more higher education type classes, that Gateway is where they would do it?
We're trying to. One of our programs right now is so that we try to partner with the Maricopa Skill Center, which is part of Gateway as well, into programs that they could easily go into as far as the programming there. I would like to see them do academic courses and migrate from their certificate program into mainstream English courses and reading courses and so on and so forth. But it's something down the road, and that I think we would like for that to happen.
So classes have been going on for about a week or so. How is, from your perspective, how are they going so far?
Well, there's a funny thing right now. They are in our new building, which is our IEB, Integrated Educational Building, and we had a kind of a funny little story. I've never taught in the building, and I've taught on that campus for 10 years, and we were laughing with Jeff Ross, who's the director of First Place, that they got first dibs on the building. So they're in the building where I've never even taught before, and so I think it lends itself to that idea that they are part of our family. They're part of Gateway. I don't want them to feel like they're not. So the first week has gone really, really, really nice.
Frank Zamora is chair of the counseling department at Gateway Community College. Frank, thanks.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Michelle Clark, and I am a first grade teacher. And we are standing in Arcadia Ice Arena, where people will play pickup hockey. This is called Heroes and Villains. Right now, I am wearing dark, which means I am a villain. But really, deep down, I'm a hero. I think hockey is the best. You are able to go so fast. You're with a team. There's so much to it. You have stick handling, shooting, and skating. And each one of those skills is super hard to master. Ice is just such a different surface. It's not ground, it's not grass like that people are used to. Ice is just so fun to be on. It's like my second home.
That was Michelle Clark playing hockey at Arcadia Ice Arena. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we belong in the penalty box, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Still to come, new ad strategies to target millennials.
When you're designing advertising or your approach for advertising, it's really about what is the messaging that you're creating that's going to resonate with that audience.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. A blowing dust advisory in effect right now for the valley until 3. There's also an urban and small stream flood advisory in effect for part of the afternoon. It's currently 98 degrees at 233.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama now has the support of enough senators to block any Republican-backed resolution which would effectively kill the nuclear agreement with Iran. Democrat Barbara Mikulski of Maryland has become the 34th senator to support the deal. Congress returns to Washington next week, and debate will begin on a GOP-sponsored resolution of disapproval of the agreement. A judge in Baltimore has ordered separate trials for the six police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray, the black man who died after sustaining serious injuries while in police custody. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has details.
State prosecutors had asked for three of the police officers to be tried together because they said their actions were interrelated and they needed to show the sequence of events to give the full account of what happened to Freddie Gray. They also said they were trying to be economical and save the state time and money. But the defense said that would be prejudicial, and the judge agreed with them.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden in Baltimore. At least 20 people are dead and dozens more wounded after two bombs exploded near a mosque in the capital of Yemen today. The first blast was reportedly detonated by a suicide bomber that was followed by a car bomb explosion targeting medics responding to the first blast. Islamic State militants in Yemen are claiming responsibility for the attacks. Vice President Joe Biden is in Florida today, a trip that could give him a sense of support in that pivotal state as he considers whether to seek the Democratic presidential nomination. Biden made a speech about the administration's education agenda at a community college in the Miami area, and he made a tongue-in-cheek remark about the throng of reporters who were present.
It's amazing how good this school is. Look at all the press you've attracted. Their interest in community colleges impressed me greatly, and I hope that's what they're going to write about.
Biden also is attending a fundraiser for Senate Democrats. The Dow was up 293 points today. This is NPR News.
Arizona's military operations account for a $9 billion economic impact on the state. That's one of the reasons people are working to make sure bases are protected from encroachment. The Sonoran Institute this summer released a report on this. Ian Dowdy, director of the Institute's Sun Corridor Legacy Program, was one of its authors. And Ian, how big of an issue is it to try to reduce encroachment around military bases in Arizona?
Yeah, I think military base preservation has come a long way in the last 20 years. I think, you know, in the 90s, we started to realize that our military installations are not always safe. And from that time, we got a lot more serious in Arizona about protecting bases. And the BRAC process in 2005, I think, was the thing that scared everybody into saying, we've got to take this really serious. This is coming. So starting in the late 90s, at the statewide level, they started to take some pretty serious measures. But it hasn't gone as far as it should. And the purpose of our work at the Sonoran Institute is to help communities across the state realize that, in fact, the best practice for protecting military installations anywhere, but especially in the West, is not just at looking around the bases themselves, right around them for encroachments, but also looking at the broader landscape.
Are there instances in the state where cities or towns or even counties maybe would like to acquire land or do something to preserve the land around a base nearby, but either don't have the money to buy it or don't have the other means by which to protect it?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of examples of cities who recognize the need to protect land around bases. A great example is around Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And
down in Tucson.
Down in Tucson. Pima County had a bond issue even that they leveraged to acquire lands around the base and in areas that were really important to protect. Davis-Monthan has had challenges for years with respect to urban encroachments. And most of our other installations don't have that level of challenge with urban encroachment.
Is development the biggest threat to military bases? Are there other things that come up on that land that could pose problems?
You know, development is probably the most visible form of encroachment that we find, but there are others. I was in Sierra Vista hosting a community forum on this very topic, and the main point of discussion was not development. The main point of discussion was electromagnetic interference. Down there, they have what's called the Buffalo Soldier electromagnetic testing ground. And what they do down there is they test equipment in this very clean spectrum of land that doesn't have a lot of interference. And so when you have new transmission lines that get built nearby, you know, even if they're, you know, some miles away from Fort Huachuca, even 30 miles away, it can create challenges. Cell phone towers, those can be a challenge as well. The other challenge we see are down in that area, you have challenges with water supply. And this is something that I think we'll see more across the state as we move forward over the next couple of decades. And so you have to always balance the need to maintain a certain level of economic development and prosperity in that region and the fact that there needs to be this continuation, the sustainability of the natural resources that are there. So that can also be a challenge.
When you talk about trying to protect a base against encroachment, how much of that discussion is about making the base look as attractive as possible and not problematic so that when base closures come about, base X is not seen as, oh, well, there's so much encroachment, we can easily close that one, nobody will care?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really important piece of this. And what we're hearing from the military community is a lot of this is about perception. And that's why we have in our report this whole new type of encroachment about perceived issues. This is a competition. I mean, the bottom line is this is a competition. When it comes down to the long term, say there's a base reallocation and closure process in the next 5 years, which there very well could be, well, now you have bases in Arizona competing against bases in Nevada and other places, trying to demonstrate that they are the very best place for the Pentagon to invest these millions of dollars. And so a lot of it is about perception. And so installations are doing a lot of work to try to maintain that perception, to try to prevent there from being complaints, to try to prevent there from being this general awareness of an issue. And it's a really big piece.
Ian Dowdy is director of the Sun Corridor Legacy Program at the Sonoran Institute. Arizona isn't the only state thinking about this. As Ian mentioned, states are competing to keep their bases open, especially when the Defense Department looks to close some. For that perspective, we turn to Jim Reed, Group Director for the Environment, Energy, and Transportation Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures.
I think one of the main approaches is to look and see what land is available around a military installation that could be preserved in some way from development that could be viewed as encroachment. And so, you know, bases have a variety of activities that go on there. And I think one of the concerns from the military side is that if there's development kind of at the gates, then it cuts down on their ability to either expand or to continue to do their mission. You know, should there start to be complaints about noise from airplanes or smoke or, you know, various things that go on at military bases, particularly around training. So one of the things is states and local entities are partnering with land conservation entities, land trusts and so forth, to try and put land around bases into a conservation easement or, you know, some kind of state where it's not going to be developed.
Are there some parts of the country or even some particular states in which encroachment is more of a problem than others?
I guess I would say it's hard to characterize by regions of the country as much as it might be more of an urban versus rural. So if you're if there's a base or an installation that's near an urban area or a metropolitan area, there's a better chance that it's going to deal with encroachment issues as opposed to, you know, a facility that's more, you know, in a rural area that doesn't have the development pressures.
Do you foresee this continuing to be a problem for bases and their surrounding communities?
You know, in those areas that are more urban and attractive places to live, you know, our population growth continues in this country. And so, you know, I think just over time that the growth in population is going to result in continued development, particularly in metropolitan areas. And so to the extent that a base is in a metro area, yes, I think there's issues there that will continue to be grappled with.
Jim Reed is Group Director for the Environment, Energy, and Transportation Program at the National Conference of State Legislatures.
The national movement of creative aging began nearly a decade ago, and the Arizona Commission on the Arts is getting involved with its own similar initiative. It's intended to emphasize the fact that creative expression and healthy aging are comfortably linked.
Alexandra Nelson is Director of Arts Learning at the Arizona Commission on the Arts. Alex, why was this a good fit for the commission?
As a society, we're slowly shifting our understanding of later life, and the creative aging movement is really about the unique ability of the arts to be a part of that shift, to help us move away from a deficits approach to aging that stresses losses to an assets approach that stresses strengths, potential, and achievement. And so the possibility that we could bring that vision to Arizona was really exciting for us.
Does it work better? Is it more promising if someone at a younger age had had a particular interest, or are we talking about someone who's a senior who takes on a new interest, and then that also opens up new areas of the brain?
I think it's both. You know, we have seen through research in this field that engagement in the arts, deep, meaningful opportunities for creative expression, can have an impact on the brain at any age. And in later life, what we see is that the three elements that really impact sense of well-being are impacted by the arts in significant ways. So the arts have the opportunity to connect older adults to their community, to help them deal with life's changes and challenges, and to sustain meaningful relationships. And so that is certainly what people are dealing with at any age. But it becomes more acute as we get older. And so when older adults have the opportunity to engage in the arts, whether they've had those opportunities as youth or not, we see these incredible gains and opportunities for them to experience life in a different way.
If you're someone who didn't really manage that creativity or didn't cultivate that creativity for decades, how challenging is it to bring it about again when you're older, and how much can this program contribute to that?
Well, you know, there's a really great example of this that comes from an organization called StageBridge. They're a theater company for older adults in California. And one of their participants was discouraged from pursuing a career in acting when she was a young woman. But after she retired, she wanted to recultivate that interest. So she started working with this company at the age of 60, and she ended up spending 30 years on the stage with them from 60 to the age of 90. So a third of her life, she was able to reinvestigate her own personal creativity and do this thing that she loved. And I think we all have that capability. So creative aging programs, what's great about them is that they take place in so many different kinds of settings, from libraries to community centers, as well as care facilities and assisted living facilities. But there are opportunities for adults ranging in age from ages 65 to 105, adults who are active to those who may be dealing with mobility or cognitive issues. So there really is something for everyone and an opportunity for everyone to explore their own creative expression.
Alexandra Nelson is Director of Arts Learning at the Arizona Commission on the Arts. Alex, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. There's a blowing dust advisory in effect for the Phoenix area for another 14 minutes or so. That'll last until 3. In addition, the National Weather Service has issued an urban and small stream flood advisory for south central Maricopa County. That's until 5 o'clock tonight. It's cloudy, 99 degrees at KJZZ at 247.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
If you read BuzzFeed or if you're a millennial, you may have noticed a BuzzFeed listicle posted on social media. It's called Life in Arizona, Expectations versus Reality, and aims to debunk some myths about living here, among them that everyone has a pool, that the heat causes things to burst into flames, and that the valley's drying up. The, quote, reality counter to that statement is that the Valley is, quote, actually really good at managing its water supply.
The article is a paid advertisement that's part of a new marketing strategy by Salt River Project and Central Arizona Project. Crystal Thompson works in CAP's communications department.
This is a joint communication campaign with CAP and SRP. We're in our 10th year of working together. Each summer typically is when we time it. And the goal is to educate the community about the importance of our water resources. What we've learned recently through a public awareness survey that CAP conducted is that less than 25% of the people under age 35 in central and southern Arizona even know that CAP is part of planning for drought preparedness. SRP did their own surveys, and they're finding the same thing. So what we decided to do this year with our campaign is to focus on that millennial generation.
Why is it important that that population knows more about what you guys are doing?
Well, because it's so clear from our public awareness surveys that that portion of the population doesn't know what we're doing currently. So by using BuzzFeed, what we know is that 50% of the visitations to BuzzFeed are the millennials. And the millennials like to communicate socially. So a lot of the traffic, about 75%, comes from social sources. So with the campaign this year, we tailored it to that audience and tried to make it something that would catch the eye of a millennial on BuzzFeed.
What do CAP and SRP gain when millennials get this information? What's better about the situation when that population knows about what's going on?
Well, that population, as with any sector of the population, should know where their water's coming from. They should know that we're prepared for drought. There's been an enormous amount of media coverage over the past year and a half about drought in neighboring states, and here we are affected by it as well. But Arizona is in a very unique place because we have spent the past decades planning for this. And so we feel like educating all sectors of the community, and with this campaign in particular, the younger generation that has now surpassed the baby boomer, know how their water is being planned for.
Do you think it ultimately will hurt conservation efforts when you're putting out the message that, hey, yes, we're in a drought, but, you know, we've done a really good job of managing our groundwater. We're okay right now. Does that also send the message that maybe you don't need to conserve so much?
Oh, not at all. A big part of this campaign is making the point about what an average person can do. And the best thing that a resident in Arizona can do is to learn about their water supply and how they can conserve. We know that conservation is critically important, and so that's an essential part of the campaign.
How did you go about trying to figure out exactly what this year's campaign would look like, what it would say, how you would tailor that message to millennials?
Primarily, what we did in the creation of that was look at the information that we knew we wanted to impart, and that is what we have on our website, droughtfacts.com. So SRP and CAP looked at that information and said, okay, we need to now find a way to drive millennials to this website. And so the advertising that, or the marketing that appears on BuzzFeed is in line with other types of information sources that you find on BuzzFeed. And so primarily we tried to be sure that what we created was the type that you would normally see there.
Crystal Thompson works in the communications department at Central Arizona Project. So how effective will this new strategy be? To find out, we turn to Zachary Fox. He's director of digital media for the Phoenix-based marketing and advertising firm Lane Terrelever.
You know, it's not necessarily a far-fetched approach. I know it's maybe a little unorthodox in terms of, or I guess in comparison to traditional advertising. When you're looking at a site like BuzzFeed and looking at the audience, that the content they typically tailor to, when you're designing advertising or your approach for advertising, it's really about what is the messaging that you're creating that's going to resonate with that audience. So in this case, if we're talking about maybe tailoring more towards a millennial audience, the advertising really needs to, it's not so much the hard sell, it's about how to propose the brand in a way where it's more of that they're sponsoring the content that's being provided on that platform. So it's not a far-fetched approach, but it's definitely different with respects to maybe traditional advertising that we would use to reach maybe through broadcast or print or even some of the other channels I mentioned, such as social and online display and video.
Is it a different approach, especially given the subject matter?
Some of the research that we've done and look at when we think of millennials and when we're trying to target them, we think of what are they more likely to engage in, or what type of creative messaging are they more likely to resonate with? And we find that typically cause brand oriented focuses do resonate with those audiences. So when we're looking at something like SRP focusing on how do they conserve water, how do they protect the water, and of course, how does that support local Arizona? That's something that typically does resonate a little higher versus just a direct buy our product, buy our services.
Is this an issue that you think millennials need to be more aware of? I mean, if you were advising the utilities, would you be telling them, yes, you need to get millennials to understand what's going on here?
I think from a gut check, yeah, I think that's probably the approach that we'd want to take. And of course, we would probably look at what is available data and research tell us. So if we were able to, if we wanted to go as far as focus groups or testing maybe previous or historical campaigns to determine, at least from an advertising standpoint, would this resonate with this audience and is it important for them to know and do those two areas align? If they do, then I think that's a good message.
Is this in some way an indication that the issue of water and water conservation is maybe more important now if these organizations are taking to sites like BuzzFeed to try to get a new audience to really understand what's going on?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're thinking of new creative ways of reaching that audience versus, again, maybe the traditional way of spreading that message from a blanket standpoint. But this is more targeted and, frankly, creative way of trying to get those audiences to think about it, to review it, and not so much just throwing it at them, but proposing it in a way where, hey, this is kind of interesting. I want to learn more. I'm going to take it upon myself to learn more.
Is it fair to make a connection between people reading that article, reading that sponsored content, and really sort of digesting what it's saying and sort of getting a better understanding of what the issue with groundwater and the water supply and conservation in the Phoenix area is, as opposed to just reading this list and saying, hey, that's kind of a fun, cool list?
I think the angle is to try and have a fun, creative approach. So again, it's not maybe one angle would be to show the facts of, you know, here's what droughts look like, and here's when water is not conserved. Here's all the nasty outcomes that can happen. But instead of maybe the harder push, it's more of a hey, you know, we all live in Arizona and we all know, you know, what it's like when it's hot, and kind of a softer lead into that. And by the time you get through that article or reading those images, you realize. This probably is an issue that maybe you weren't thinking of prior to, or you weren't expecting to learn about. So I think the angle there is then, since it is a sponsored post and it's very clear that it's a sponsored post, it kind of leads you into, if you wanted to learn more, you can take that action.
Zachary Fox is Director of Digital Media for the Phoenix-based marketing and advertising firm Lane Terrelever. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. In a riverbed in Iowa just a couple of years ago, some geologists were digging around during a mapping survey, and they hit something.
Something weird and gigantic. What they found were fossils, but these were fossils full of claws and armor. And it turns out it was a new species, new to us anyway, that patrolled the oceans more than 460 million years ago.
These were scorpions, it turns out, but these aren't the 1 to 3 inch little scorpions you might be used to seeing scamper around a campsite. No, these were bigger, a lot bigger. James Lambsdell's going to tell us how much bigger. He's the lead researcher and author of the study detailing this discovery. He's also a postdoctoral associate at Yale. James Lambsdell, welcome to the show.
Hello.
I said bigger, much bigger. How much bigger?
So the largest ones we have were probably about 1.7 meters long, almost the size of your sort of average adult man.
5'7", I guess. I just sort of did a calculation in my head, 5'6" or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That is an imposing, gigantic scorpion. Are they just like the scorpions that we're used to, only scarily huge?
These things were actually quite different because, of course, they were living in the sea rather than on the land. They had the hind legs were modified into these paddles to allow them to swim. And they don't have single sort of pincers at the front of the head. Instead, they have multiple sets of legs which have these great big spines on them that allow them to grab prey and tear it apart and then push it towards the mouth.
Now, we should say this is a gigantic predator that roamed the Earth 460 million years ago, is before the appearance of the dinosaurs. So these huge scorpion-like creatures were on the scene at a very, very early stage here.
Yeah, they predate dinosaurs by about 210 million years. And what's going on at this time is we do not have much on land at all. All of the biodiversity is in the oceans. And during the Ordovician, which is when this thing was living, we are having this revolution of these complex ecosystems starting to evolve and build up. And we're finding out that these animals, which we did not realize were around at this point in time, this is 10 million years older than the other sea scorpions that we found, were important members of these early ecosystems and very quickly became dominant predators.
What accounts for the enormous size in these ancient creatures?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think being in the marine realm definitely helps you get larger because you don't have the full effect of gravity pulling you down. Possibly at this period in time, what's helping these things is either changes in the atmosphere or ocean chemistry, or potentially just the lack of these large vertebrate predators. So things like us will compete for resources with these things. And that is potentially why just the lack of competition and the ability to just grow and grow and grow is just allowing these things sort of unfettered ability to grow as large as they physically can.
Unfettered is right. And we should also say you found one that was 1.7 meters. That doesn't mean it was the largest one. That's just the one that you found.
Oh, totally. These things shed exoskeletons. So the largest one would have shed that exoskeleton and then grown some more. So these things probably got bigger than that.
Potentially much bigger. You need to find another fossil to know. These fossils were found in a riverbed. You said these were marine creatures. So this upper Iowa region where your fossil was found used to be under the ocean.
Yeah, basically at this period in time, North America was part of this supercontinent called Laurentia. Iowa at the time was on the coastline. And so we had this deep ocean. And then these animals were living in an old meteorite crater that sort of provided a sheltered, less oxygen-rich environment that they could congregate into and molt without anything disturbing them.
All right, before we let you go, Dr. Lambsdale, I'm going to take a crack at this. Pentacopterus decorahensis. Did I get it right?
Yep, that's perfect.
Pentacopterus, a giant, well, from our point of view anyway, giant sea scorpion, 1.7 meters. That's 5.5 feet to you and me. Ancient scorpion discovered under what is today a river in Iowa. James Lambsdale is the lead researcher and author of the study detailing this scarily giant ancient scorpion. He's a postdoctoral associate at Yale. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon for the show at 2 o'clock, an anniversary for a court set up specifically to help homeless Valley residents. And a new documentary investigates Arizona's deadliest gunfight. Hint, it's not the one you're thinking of. Those stories and a whole lot more on the show tomorrow afternoon at 2, right here on KJZZ. The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director is Al Macias.
Our executive producer is John, the voracious one, Hoban. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD at 3 o'clock.